My name is Michael Lennox, for those of you that are in the grocery store. I make a lot of games for the Sixers. I part owner of a company called ArmorCast. I've never heard of ArmorCast. A couple people. Okay. We make toys for nerds, everything from miniatures to model kits to resin terrain, decals, all kinds of stuff for the miniatures and wargaming market. We're also branching out into role-playing games and tabletop games as well. I also own a part company called Burning River Games, which makes specific types of miniature games for the state market. So to get started here, I think I probably should have budgeted a little more time for this presentation. I think it's going to end up running a little longer, but if we run out of time, I believe there's a breakout session upstairs somewhere. Afterwards, I'll keep going up there, and if you kick us out of there, I'll answer questions in the hallway if anyone wants to stick around that. All right, so a little bit about tabletop game design. If you've got an idea for a game, and you want to make that game happen, there's a number of ways you can go about doing it. Most notably, actually producing a game, a physical object. You can also do a number of other things related to licensing. There are three roads that you can take to get your game to market. You can license your idea directly, making a pitch to an actual company. You can license through an agent who can be pitching for you, or you can self-publish. I personally am a fan of self-publishing. I'm going to touch on the first two briefly. And in particular, in regard to 4 points. The profit that you can make from your product actually getting to market. When I'm talking about success, I'm talking about actually getting the product out there and made so that people can purchase it. Difficulty in regards to how much effort you're going to have to put in. And then control, which is how much creative control you're going to get out of working on your project. So direct licensing. There's a number of things you're going to consider when you go to make your pitch to a company. First thing you're going to want to consider is the company profile. What type of company are you approaching? What do they mainly do? What kind of games do they produce? What is their target market? If you've come up with the greatest idea ever for Zombie Hooker Orgy Slaughter Maximus, not going to want to pitch that to Mattel. They're going to probably throw you out into the curb almost immediately. However, if you pitch that to, say, blood-drinking goth games, might pick it up. You never know. When you actually make your pitch to a company, if you're taking it to a Mattel or a WotC or Steve Jackson Games or whoever, you're going to want to have a couple of things in your arsenal to try and get your game sold. You're going to want to have a demo. You're going to want to have a design document. You're going to want to have artwork. You're going to want to be able to wow them with the concept for your game. And most importantly, you're going to want to have more than one concept. Ideas, as they say, are a dime a dozen. And in the gaming industry, everybody who works in it, the guys that are making the pieces on the shop floor, the custodians that are sweeping up at night, everybody's got an idea for a game. So ideas coming out of nowhere, they're used to getting hundreds of these things, thousands of these things year round, and almost none of them ever get made. If you're lucky enough, however, to get one made, and actually if you're lucky enough to get an audience with a game manufacturer in the first place, you're gonna wanna have multiple proposals. Has anyone heard of Richard Garfield? Couple people again. He's the mathematics professor that designed Magic the Gathering, which a lot of you probably heard of. It was originally started as a sort of a thought experiment in a game he was using to teach his grad students and work out game theory and design, something he was doing for fun. He took a game that he had actually designed and intended to sell called Robo Rally and went to a company that at the time was called Wizards, now it's called Wizards of the Coast. And he said, I got this cool game. You get these little robot figures, and you put them on a map, and then you get your cards, and you make your program, and the robot does stuff every turn to turn. They looked at him and said, that's really nice. What else you got? And he said, I got this card game thing that I do with my grad students, and it kind of works like this. And he drew some cards up on the spot, and he said, hey, that's a really neat idea. I think we can make some money off of that. So you're always going to want to have not just a backup pitch, but multiple backups. There's other licensing considerations when you're trying to license directly. If you've come up with a game, say for example it's a Star Wars Pod Racer board game, you're going to have to go get permission and license the Star Wars property from LucasArts. If you're going to need artwork made, if you're going to need boxes made, if you're going to need a game design system, if all you've got is an idea, all those things are going to have to be either created or licensed from somebody somewhere. And then that comes down to the actual sale of your game. A lot of people will say, well, I don't really care about making money, I just want to see my game made. That almost guarantees that your idea is not going to get heard. Mostly because every situation that started out like that has ended up with the 16-year-old who comes up with a cool video game concept, who gives it away, whose parents come back and say, wait a minute, you just made $10 million off my kid's idea. I think we deserve a piece of this money, and results in a lawsuit. So they're going to want to pay you for it, but for the most part, they're not going to want to actually just pay you outright for a game. They're going to want to pay you by a royalty. So if it goes nowhere, if it does nothing, if it loses money, they don't owe you anything. By the same token, they ensure that you get an appropriate piece of the pie, depending upon how successful the game actually is. And then, of course, there's all the other legal stuff they're going to hit you with. They're going to hit you with non-disclosure agreements, non-compete agreements. You're going to have, in addition to your licensing and royalty agreements, you're going to have your contract agreement. You're going to have signing over of intellectual property. You're going to have all kinds of stuff. They're going to hit you with reams of paper. So either be a lawyer or know a really good one. And how does that factor into our four points? Well, when you're licensing directly, it gets you a decent amount of profit. Your chunk's not going to be as big as if you actually made the game yourself, because obviously they've got to pay everybody that works on the project along with you or for you, under you, when you've made your actual product. But it's a relatively safe way to go about doing it. Degree of success depends on the market, who you go to. A lot of companies, if they like the idea, will simply buy it up if they don't foresee that it's viable in the market currently, and they'll sit on the property. And once you've sold it, you no longer have control over it. And they'll say, yeah, it's a really neat idea, but we think it competes with something of ours, so we're not going to make it, at least right now. So it might not actually happen. Difficulty, well, in the actual effort you have to expend, if you can get somebody who has bought your idea, well, once they've it's pretty much up to them. You're more or less done. But that, of course, factors into control, is even though it's easy to get your game made once you've actually gone and sold your idea, you're not going to have input over what it looks like. Your rule set's probably going to get tweaked. They're going to change things around. But you've given it up, but you've created your game. Which leads me to licensing through an agent. Well, why do you get an agent? All that legal stuff that I talked about, the non-disclosure agreements, shopping it to a game firm, getting together a portfolio, agents deal with this stuff all the time. It's their job. The cost of getting an agent, well, they work kind of like lawyers. Usually you got to pay a retainer, and a lot of times they're going to take a percentage based on what you earn over the lifetime of the product. Are they worth it? Well, that's a matter of opinion. If you've got infinite time and infinite money and all you want to do is sit around and create games all day, by all means, go through an agent. If you're dead set against self-publishing, I definitely recommend going through an agent rather than trying to direct license. Even though it's going to cost you more money and take a little bit more out of your profit, it does make it easier for you effort-wise. It does guarantee a greater degree of success of your product actually making it to the marketplace. Because the agent will have a vested interest in getting their percentage of the royalties coming back off of your cut. So it depends largely what you want to do. And also, if you do have an agent, it does limit your control again somewhat, as you have yet another intermediary and third party that you're going to have to work through in order to get your product made. Which brings us to self-publishing, which I'm personally a fan of. It gives you the greatest amount of control over what your actual product is going to look like, is going to feel like, is going to play like. It almost guarantees success. If you're dedicated to your project, if you have a game that you believe needs to be in the market, you'll make it happen. The profits, well, they're all going to be yours, and assuming you've done your homework and priced things appropriately, you'll be making, I'm not going to say the big bucks, but you'll at least be making the money off of your product as opposed to getting a small percentage-based royalty from a firm that may or may not even produce your end product. The downside to self-publishing is you have to do all the effort, all the stuff about the contracts, the non-disclosure agreements, actually making the product physically yourself, all the design work. It all has to be done by you or by your team. Which brings us to the design process. There are five phases to the design process. A lot of this looks like a video game design process. A lot of it looks like a movie design process. And designing a board game has a lot of things in common with both of those. The five phases are, of course, the concept phase, pre-production, production, post-production, and the aftermarket phase. The concept, also known as the idea. Like I said, ideas are a dime a dozen. And the first time you get an idea and you're going to go tell your best buddy how it's going to be and how it's going to be the greatest game ever, no matter how good you think it is, the first time you try to tell it to somebody, you're going to look like a special ed kid who's just been given a sparkler. It always comes across this way. I've seen guys at conventions come up to me trying to tell me the greatest game idea that they just got from playing somebody else's game, and I just have to sit there and go, that's fantastic. Write me up a design document and we'll talk. So where do you get your concepts from, your ideas from? Well, there's a number of sources. Inspiration is, in my opinion, the best one. It all comes from your head. Everything that comes out of it, you own. You can also license things, like I said, a Star Wars-based game, a pod racer game, a Star Trek-based fleet battle game, what have you. Sometimes ideas come from a gameplay method. Someone's working out a new way to use the ever-popular D20, and they want to apply it to a war game, so they figure out a system. Well, they've come up with the gameplay system first, and then they adapt a game around that afterwards. Then, of course, you have the gap, which is a gap in the market that you discern needs to be filled. For example, right now in the 28mm miniatures wargaming market, there's Warhammer 40,000 for sci-fi, and that's about it. So maybe there's room, maybe there isn't room. Maybe you foresee that there's space in the market to have another 28mm dark future science fiction game. There is, of course, always the option for the sequel. Now, unless you're actually part of a design firm or you've been creating games for a while, this probably isn't going to come up, but it's possible. There was a game that came out in the mid-90s called Warzone, which was based off of the Mutant Chronicle intellectual properties that got swapped around to a number of companies in an attempt to maximize profit and ultimately torpedoed the game, and they're always talking about bringing it back. So it's possible that somewhere out there you get your hands on the Mutant Chronicles IP for producing a miniatures game and you can bring it back as Warzone version 2.0. And last but not least, coattails, which kind of goes along with licenses. The new Green Lantern movie's coming out this summer. Maybe you want to make a Candyland-style Green Lantern Journey to Oa board game. You're going to want it to be done and launched so that it pulls in market revenue based on being of the coattails of the movie. Okay, so pre-production. There's a number of things you're going to need to consider when you're in your pre-production phase for producing your game. The first is the design document, which we'll come to in a minute, as well as how you're going to structure your company, your actual gameplay idea, and you're going to want to build a budget and a schedule. The actual design document works a lot like a business brief. So if you hate business school, you're probably not going to like this part, but it's actually pretty important no matter if you're self-publishing, licensing, or licensing through an agent. And definitely if you're licensing through an agent, they're going to make you do this. It consists of three parts, the first part being a memo. This is one, two paragraphs top. It's a brief description. It's what you want the person to read to first get them hooked into the novel concept that is your game. A lot of it doesn't go into technical rules, but it describes the scenario, it describes the background of your game. And this can take many forms. The original document brief for Magic the Gathering, for example, was the story of the war between the brothers Urza and Mishra. The memo for Warhammer 40,000 was, what if we took this fantasy stuff that we've been mucking around with and chucked it 40,000 years into the future? It gives them a basic idea. They can read it in one paragraph and decide, hey, do I want to read more? Then that gets you to your actual brief. Now, this is going to be several pages, usually in the realm of 1 to 5, depending on the complexity of your game. And this is where you're going to describe the backstory. You're going to talk about the system you've created. You're going to talk about the beautiful universe that you've conceptualized for your game. You're going to talk about the artwork. You're going to talk about lots and lots of different things that will entice somebody to want to play your game. And then there's the main actual design document itself, or as I call it, the meat of the document, which is anywhere between 5, and I've seen them as long as 50 pages, depending on complexity. You start talking about rules, you put in charts, you put in concept artwork, you put in photos of prototype models. You give them lots and lots of pretty pictures, and you show them what this game is going to be like. You give them an idea of how it's played. And not just that, but you include fluff and background, and you want to hook them into your world and get whoever you're presenting this to, whether it's your design team or a CEO at Mattel, to want to make this game along with you the way that you see it. Now, when you're writing your design document, just write. Put out details, stream of consciousness, pull up your word processor, fill pages, sort it out later. The reason I suggest that you do this is because some of the best ideas that have come along, and some of the most profitable that have come along, have been little scraps that have been just thrown away in details that have been pinned to a poster board somewhere. Someone's trying to brainstorm ideas for their design document. As I intimated before, Rick Priestley was working on Warhammer Fantasy version 3.0 for Games Workshop at the time in the mid-80s and put forth the idea, what if this was 40,000 years in the future? It was on a post-it note and sat on a bulletin board that people stared at for almost 5 years before they said, hey, I think Rick's got a pretty good idea. And it was just a throwaway thing that he'd come up in just a brainstorming design phase working on the design document for the next generation of Warhammer. All right, now your actual company. I can't tell you how important this is. I have seen more self-publishing startups die because they did not fully put down and categorize and spell out how the company was, what it was going to run. A lot of times it's two guys working in their basement, they get a neat idea, they're a basic partnership, they have a falling out, the company gets dissolved, they fight over the intellectual property of who actually owns it, and the entire thing goes nuclear and nobody gets anything made. As a result, spell out, if you're working by yourself, okay, you're going to do all this stuff. You're going to be the CEO, the CFO, you're going to be head of production, you're going to be the lead designer, you're going to be the producer, the art guy, the music guy, what have you. If you're working with other people, make sure that everybody has an assigned job description, and include in that, in addition to your officers, duties and areas of responsibility. If you want your chief information officer of your 5-man startup to only worry about running the back end of things because you want to outsource everything that's going to the web, make sure you spell that out so that he doesn't decide, hey, I'm the CIO, I'm going to run everything that goes out to the web, even though I haven't updated my skill set since 1995, and try to build a website based on that. A lot of this goes along with the contracts that you'll pull up. Chances are, unless you're amazingly talented, which I am not, you're going to be bringing in outside help. You're going to be finding an artist to do your cover art. You're going to be finding sculptors. You're going to be finding people to help you design and alpha test and beta test. Get contracts made up, especially with deadlines. Get people to sign those contracts so that they know, hey, if I don't deliver on time your piece of cover artwork by May 1st so you can get it to the printers by June 1st so you can launch at Gen Con on August 1st, I'm not getting paid for my efforts, which also goes a long way to protect you. And then, of course, there's other legal issues that you'll have to handle, particularly in your operating agreement, which brings me to the concept of the LLC. Get one of those. Don't be a partnership. Don't be a sole proprietorship. Don't be an LLP. Don't try to be a C-Corp, S-Corp, anything else. Get yourself an LLC with a good, solid operating agreement set up and filed. There are a number of cases where guys have just hung out their shingle as a sole proprietorship. Somebody decides, hey, I don't like what you're doing. I'm going to sue you. and oh, you're a sole proprietorship. Now that I've taken all the assets of the company, I'm going after your house and your paycheck and your kids' college tuition because I don't like the fact that I think you infringed on my intellectual property. So protect yourself. Get yourself an LLC, put everything in contracts, write down your operating agreement. Which brings us to the actual gameplay. So you've got your novel idea for a game. Let's run with the Green Lantern shoots and ladders style game going to OA. You've got your idea. Well, what type of game is it going to be? Is it going to be a card game? Is it going to be a board game? Is it going to be something you're going to launch on the computer? Is it going to be something you're going to launch on the web? Are you going to instead decide that this is going to be a better role-playing game part of the way in? You're going to want to decide this early on and pick the type of game that you're going to make. Now, at this point in gameplay, you're only coming up with the basic idea. Okay, I want it to be a shoots and ladders type game that uses some dice and some cards and a game board that predicts what pieces do. Which brings me to my next point of gameplay and copyrights. I'm not a lawyer, and I'll come back to this later, but when it comes to copyrights, you can't copyright a specific mechanic in a game. A roll of a D10 and a 10% base percentage system with two rolls of D10 together, you can't copyright it. It's two dice being rolled together, figuring out your number between 1 and 100. However, you can copyright a complete game system. So when you're thinking about how you want to design your game, when you're thinking about how you want your game to actually play, don't go and say, hey, War Gods Egyptus has a great game system. I'm just going to use theirs. That'll get you sued. But hey, War Gods Egyptus did a really nifty thing with how you handle terrain, and I like how Battletech handled terrain, and if I merge the two together, I get a system that I like and that works for my miniatures game. That you're probably okay with. And last but not least, for pre-production, a budget and schedule. Make them, stick to them. Adjust them as necessary, and try to set an end goal. I want my project to be done and to market and ready by Christmas, or ready for a big launch at GAMMA, which is the Game Manufacturers Association trade show. You want to stick to this as best you can, and this helps not just you, even if you're a sole proprietorship, but it helps keep everybody else in line, like I said, your artist who's got to get you cover art in time, your sculptor who's got to get pieces to you so they can be produced in time, and so on. And yeah, you can change your end goal, and sometimes that happens, but try to stick to your budget and schedule so that it doesn't become the perpetual project that never finishes. Which gets us to actual production. Again, there are five segments to production: writing, gameplay, alpha testing, your marketing plan, and again, more legal stuff. Production writing. I can't stress enough that the story is the most important part of the game that you're actually going to produce. Doesn't matter what kind of game it is, how well it works, or what kind of novel concept you've come up with for actually creating your game. The story is by far the most important. Again, to go back to our example of Warhammer 40,000, high fantasy, set in deep space, dark future. Game system, is it okay? There are better ones. There are worse ones. It's a matter of opinion. Different people like different styles, but it's the one that makes the most money because it's got the story that sucks everybody in. When you're writing for your production, follow your design document. Okay, if you've come up with an idea mid-writing of, hey, this would be really neat if I did this as a 6mm game instead of a 28mm game, set that aside, make it your post-it note back on your corkboard. Try and stick with what you've set out to do to keep yourself from being completely sidetracked by other projects. Again, write everything down. Go ahead, open up Word, put it all in there. A little bit of advice I learned a long time ago, 1 hour of planning is worth 10 hours of work. Make yourself an outline. Pull up Visio, SpiderMap, CMap, something. Lay out what you're going to do. Make yourself an outline for what you're going to want your book to work like. And once you've done that, split up the work. If someone's better at rules as part of your team, assign them to do the rules. If someone is better as a background story writer or universe creator, let them do that. If someone is better at figuring out the mathematical end of the gameplay, let them do this. But again, let the ideas flow. Don't discard anything out of hand. Then we get to gameplay part two. There's a number of things that you're going to consider based on what we talked about in gameplay part one, of once you've established the type of game you're going to make, the system that it's going to use. You're going to want to pick your base system. And what I mean by base system is the underlying mechanic that's going to determine the random results for your game. Whether that's a multi-dice bubble popper from Trouble, or whether it's a D10-based game, or a D20-based game, or a D6-based game. All of these have inherent constraints to them, and they also have inherent benefits, which brings us to the sweet spot. When you talk about the sweet spot, in a D6-based game, most games roll 2D6 and then determine a result. Well, what's the set of results that's most likely to come up, the number that's most likely to be produced on a pair of two dice rolled and added together? It's the number 7. And there are derivations moving out that become less and less likely. Well, if you're rolling 2d10s together, 10 and 11 become your most likely numbers, 10 in particular, because there's the most combinations available on the dice. But 11 is not that much less likely to happen, neither is 9, as compared to, say, with a d6, where it's much harder to get a 6 or an 8 rather than it is a 7. So it widens the sweet spot in your gaming system. So whatever you're going to design, bear that in mind. So for example, going back to the land of Warhammer that I know so well in the D6 systems, since 7 is your average value for 2 dice, most things are built around a stat line of 4 rolling above or below with modifiers as appropriate. And this has some inherent advantages in that it keeps the number system simple, but at the same time has some disadvantages, because how different can you really make all the varying units when you've only got a spread of 10 numbers to work with, or 11 numbers as opposed to 20 numbers or 100 numbers or 1,000 numbers. But the trade-off is, of course, complexity versus simplicity, and you're going to have to decide that for how you want your game to work. Which brings us to the actual mechanics of the game. Oop, let me go back one. There we go. The mechanics are the underlying idea of how this is going to work. What's our measuring system going to be? What is going to be our terrain system, our cover system? What's our THACO? What is our tapping system? Whatever have you. It's your fleshed out, completed design segment by segment. So that as you're working on your production level gameplay, your mechanics are going to determine the look and feel of your game. And you're going to want to keep this in mind. If you're playing a game that you want to be fast-moving and fast-paced, well, when you're working on your mechanics, you don't want to say, okay, let's see, I've got my two giant robots fighting each other, and there's a tree in between, and this guy's peeking out from the side, so there's going to be a +2 modifier there, but it's his offhand eye that he's shooting with, so there's going to be a +5 modifier here, but he's behind hardcover. That's not going to be a fast-moving game. So keep that in mind when you design your mechanics. And the mechanics and the look and feel are going to directly influence the rules that you're going to create. And the rules can be very simple. The rules can be very complex. Again, it depends the type of game you're trying to create. And when it comes to rules, I really do believe that less is really more. One of the simplest, oldest, and most tactically complex and challenging games that's out there is chess. It's a few dozen pieces on a white checkerboard, yet it's a game that has resolved world conflicts and spared armies. Yet it is insanely complex, and there are people that spend their lifetime studying chess and never master it or become a grandmaster. So just because it's not initially complex doesn't mean it's not tactically complex, doesn't mean there isn't that level of flexibility. Which brings me to a little fun quote. Anton de Saint-Exupéry, who wrote The Little Prince, was once quoted as saying, "Perfection is achieved not when there is nothing more to add, but when there is nothing left to take away." And this is something that if you're going to try and design an actual game, is something you really want to take to heart. I can't tell you how many games have a wonderful concept, but by the time you spend 5 minutes figuring out the modifiers to figure out what happened from one action, and it's suddenly 25 minutes later and someone needs a smoke break, probably could have taken a little away from that. Which brings us to alpha testing. Your mantra here should be play test. Oops. Dang it. silly laptop. Playtest. A lot of companies skimp on the alpha testing. Once you've got your game rule set, just start playing. Sit down with your friends, take it to your local gaming group, bring in people who've never seen the game before, and just play it. And when you're playing it, record your test sessions. Break out a video camera, break out a flip phone, at the very least pull out an audio recorder so that you get everything that you're talking about and things that you notice, and you can come back to them later and not have them be altered by perception when you're wondering, oh, what did we figure out that really worked well there? By that same token, take notes, but if you've got a good video camera going, notes are a little less important unless you want to highlight some things. And you're going to encounter what a lot of gamers like to call cheesy, beardy, and broken. Cheesy is good, beardy is not so good, broken is bad. Cheese is actually a necessity in every game. And what cheese is it's that little bit of unbelievability that stretches the imagination, that allows for something fantastical to happen in the game, but isn't completely over the top and doesn't make the game unfun for everyone else. It can be anything from a simple modifier that you add to a game or a result of a die roll based on a specific weapon or a specific rule set, or for that matter, simply landing on the wrong square and going down the wrong chute to make the game more interesting, to add that cinematic moment to what you're playing. But the thing you have to be careful for is the beardiness and the brokenness. And the more complex your game, the more likely you're going to run into beardy concepts and broken concepts. Beardy concepts are things that can be exploited by a really crafty player to derail a game. Classic example, of course, of that would be the player that looks through his army book and figures out the exact build to completely nullify another opponent's army. In an ideal world, everything will be fair and balanced, and again, if you play tested enough and alpha tested and beta tested enough, you're not going to run into that. Broken is beardy to the next level. Broken is when you've got an army list, a deck in Magic, a character class, what have you, that is so over the top, overpowerful, it not only ruins the good time of one type of player that you might encounter, but everyone else's player. The example I like to use there is the second edition D&D cleric of a warrior priest. He can use edge weapons, he can carry heavy armor, he can cast healing spells, he can cast magic spells, and he can tank at the same time. Oh, and he can use magic items. Why do you need anybody else? He's ruined everybody else's fun. Which brings us to marketing. You're going to want to know your target audience. If you're creating a game for war gamers that you want to have the most tactically complex yet easy, cheap to make war game, you want to put out a classic Avalon Hill-based game or a train game or something like that, know that your audience is going to be guys in their late 50s who don't like spending money, and you're going to have to make sure that you gauge your game and what you actually put out in the market appropriately. The other thing you're going to want to try and keep in mind is, what do you as a company do? If you had one sentence to describe your gaming company, what would you do? If you asked someone at Ford, what does Ford do? We make cars. If you asked one of the guys at, say, the subdivision of Magic, subdivision of Wizards of the Coast, that does Magic the Gathering, we make Magic the Gathering. That's going to be your sentence. So whatever you do, make sure that you've designed your business around that and that you're designing your marketing around that. Knowing what your assets are and what your strengths are as that particular type of business, because you're going to want to leverage that as much as possible. ArmorCast, of which I'm a partner, has a really big history in resin casting and making terrain. So everything that we've done in the past several years has been geared around getting people to buy more of our really high-quality terrain. So we're designing games that use our terrain. We're designing products that use our resin casting abilities. We're designing a role-playing game that uses the figures we make, that uses the decals we make, that fits on the terrain that we make. All of it is designed to better leverage what we do best as a business. And the same goes for anything else. If you're building models in your basement, if you're making CCGs. Everything that you do as a business should be geared around leveraging the fact that you make the greatest CCG in the land, and you're going to want to try and make as much money off of that with complementary products and services and how you geared your business. And last but not least, in the era of the website, put everything you can on the web. Get a development blog, get a website going, get a YouTube channel, start a podcast, get stuff on other people's podcasts, get on the forums. This is the number one failing of most small businesses, is they put together one website or one forum and hope that it's going to get everywhere. You should be spending every free minute of the day talking up your product, sending it out to guys running their podcasts so they can try it out and give you a good, hopefully good review. Putting a development blog up to show people what it is that you do and how your products are coming along. Essentially, keep them in the loop and get them invested early. Okay, the legal stuff. I am not a lawyer. I'm going to say this again, but it's really important. Don't consider anything I say legal advice. Don't say, hey, that Mike guy at Nauticon told me I can go do this. If you have any legal questions, go find an actual lawyer. In particular, go find a patent or an IP lawyer, which is what a lot of this applies to. Okay, when you've started a business and all you've got is an idea and your name, protect your idea, protect your name. You're going to want to try to get as many copyrights, trademarks, and patents, if you can, squared away as early as possible to lock down your ideas so no one else can come along and pinch them from you. And the beautiful thing about IP protection is that once you've signed up for it, it may take you 5 years, 10 years to get a patent through, for example, but if someone's infringed upon it after day two after the application, you can sue them for damages going all the way back to day two, not from the point at which the patent's actually approved. Now the difference that you're going to have between these three things, patents are for processes, they're for how you make stuff. Chances are this isn't going to come up a whole lot in game design, unless you've come up with something really new and novel. However, copyrights and trademarks you're going to be seeing a lot of. And copyrights by themselves, it costs $30 to register a copyrighted piece of material. You can do it on the web. So the moment you get your first draft of your book written, you copyright it, you send in your $30, you're protected. And the copyright covers things like specific characters, it's going to cover ideas, it's going to cover concepts, it's going to cover what you've come up with out of your head. Now trademarks are different from copyrights. Trademarks are actual marks of trade that you're going to do business under. Coca-Cola is a trademark, Xerox is a trademark, Ford Motor Company is a trademark, and if you've trademarked your name, Joe Bob's Game and Shack, no one else can go out there and do business under the name of Joe Bob's Game and Shack. And if somebody, say for instance, squats on your website of Joe Bob's Game and Shack, you can say, hey, that's my trademark, I should have that website, and you can get relief through the courts that way. It's a little harder than that, but you get the idea. And a lot of what else goes along with production legal is licensing for again, things like artwork, multimedia, other things like that. Stuff that you're going to have to pay other folks to make if you don't have the skills to make yourself, in order to both ensure that they get paid, in order to ensure that you don't get ripped off and sued later. And then there's also a lot of disclaimers and notifications and end-user license agreement types of things. Now, a lot of this is up in the air, but if you look at, for example, Games Workshop, they've got 8 pages of disclaimers and notifications about what you can and can't do with anything that may or may not be based on their intellectual property. Will it all hold up? Well, there's some court cases pending right now, which I'll come back to a little bit later, but at least they put it out there and got it out front and hopefully discouraged at least some people and put up at least a basic protection from themselves. Which brings us to post-production, which is actually making stuff. It also includes your QA, your beta testing, your actual full-on production, your sales, your advertising, and your actual relief. So making stuff, I'm talking about sculpting, cover art, graphics, layout, prototypes, things that you're going to need to put together as your first run in order to get your concept worked out, in order to be able to move into full-on production based on what you've created. Which brings us to QA. both in terms of in-house and out-of-house beta testing. You're definitely going to want to try and get as many groups of different individuals to try your game. A lot of people will do it for free, especially if you fling them a little free product. Say, hey, you know, I'll give you a starter set when it releases if you fill out 4 battle reports and file them on our beta testing forum. Or you document your games and send me the video files, I'll make sure that you get a box of whatever when we release it. And listen to your beta testers. They're going to come up with a lot of things that you didn't think of. They're going to find the loopholes in your rules. They're going to find ideas that maybe you didn't think of, or interpretations of things that you've written that you didn't intend for it to go this way. Now, some of them can be fixed at this point of post-production. Some of them can't. A lot of times, beta testers get the first runs of the game where a major rework is not possible. But you can start working on your errata and your FAQs to put out your updates as soon as possible after the launch of your game to ensure that everything runs smoothly the way that you intended it in the first place. And then there's a couple pieces of software that you might want to pick up depending on what you're building. Battle Chronicler and Army Builder, if you're not familiar with those. Battle Chronicler is useful both for making nice pretty diagrams of troop movements and things like that. You can input your own images into files in order to make nice graphics that can then be reused in your books. Army Builder is a point-and-click system for army creation. They also have a version called Hero Lab, which is useful for a lot of RPG-style characters, and another one called Card Vault, which is useful for designing decks and CCGs. And although the programs cost a few bucks each, they're not horrible. They're like $30, $40 licenses. Usually get a couple of licenses with them, and the entire developer kits are all free. So if you buy Army Builder and you're making a miniatures war game, you can build your entire system in and release a file that people can then use to speed up playing your game more and hopefully finding more things that they want to buy and build more products. Which brings us to the actual production itself. When you're self-publishing especially, you're going to probably want to run a just-in-time production. Some places, especially if you're outsourcing, a lot of what you're making are going to have minimum quantities that you're going to want to buy, or that they're going to want you to buy, rather. But you're going to want to try and keep that as minimized as possible. For a while, it's going to take a while to get most games off the ground, especially to build a core following, unless you've stumbled upon a mega hit and get some great publicity up front. You're going to want to be producing roughly as it's needed to minimize your costs to try and keep your business as solvent as long as possible. And then we get into some of our actual productions for printing and metal casting and resin casting and injection molding and packaging.
Hello.
Here we go. Printing, a lot of this can be done just from your basic home desktop computer. The layout tools you want are going to be things that most of us already have in our arsenal, InDesign, Photoshop, Illustrator, and so on. And depending on whether you're going with offset printing or digital printing on demand, different printers are going to have different requirements. Furthermore, if you have access to a very nice printer or a very nice set of copiers, you can actually print a lot of your own things and have them, you know, semi-professionally bound at a Kinko's if that's the way you want to go. But ultimately, your printing is largely going to be left up to the discretion of who's doing the actual work, whether it's yourself or someone that you've hired. So there are some reasonable offset printers. There's a company here in Cleveland called Veta & Sons, who are very good, who have reasonably low production runs on a lot of things, who can do things like book bindings and full-color offset printing. And of course, there's things like Cafe Press, which we've all heard of, that sometimes have the quality, not always, but you can get one book if all you need is one book to fill an order. Now, the question of full color does come up on occasion. Ultimately, it's a personal choice. I've seen a lot of books for a lot of games sell solely because of the artwork and being in full color. If you've ever walked around Gen Con, you'll see guys going over to the Paizo booth to buy a stack of 40 and 50 and $100 game books for the latest Pathfinder things, solely because it's in full color and it's full of Wayne Reynolds artwork, which they love, even if they're never going to play the game. Some of the things that are full color that are actually pretty reasonable, and I brought one here with me. This is a game, I don't make it, but it's a fun one called Dystopian Wars. If any of you have ever seen this, it's basically what if World War I and World War II got smashed together just after the Civil War thanks to lots of weird steampunk technology. It's a really nice full-color game book that sells for $30 a piece. So realistically, if you're getting a decent deal on printing for a fair volume, you're probably not paying more than about $5 to $6 for one of these books. Granted, you're probably buying 1,000 of them on an initial run, but if you plan on this game being around for a while and putting it into distribution, that's not quite so big of a deal. Another note on printing, if you're simply wanting to get your game out there as quick as possible, there's a wonderful website called DriveThruRPG that has PDF saleable downloads for every kind of game under the sun. And they can get you set up with an account for free, and they basically take a cut of the profits of whatever it is for more or less running a PDF-based web store for you. And of course, since it's a PDF, you can then do full color, and it's up to whoever actually downloads the thing to go ahead and get it printed the way they want. Which brings us to some basic points of metal casting. Cost and equipment. To do pewter white metal casting in your garage is going to cost you anywhere between about $2,500 and $7,000, depending on what rig you buy and from whom. But it's going to require a mold press, a vulcanizer. It's going to require a melting pot, an air compressor, and a spin caster. And these are available from a variety of companies, which I've got listed later, as well as finding them on eBay. Your master models, there are some safe materials and unsafe materials which you need to consider when you're making your master for your miniature or your game piece or your custom-made die. Metals and epoxy resins are fine. Things like urethane resins, rubbers of various kinds, plastics, clays, Sculpey glue, super glue, do not put those in your master molds, and I'll come back to that in a second. So when you're actually making a mold, the vulcanizing press has two unvulcanized rubber discs. You create a cavity in the disc, put in your master model, or multiple master models as the case may be, and actually press it in the vulcanizing press anywhere from between 2 to 20,000 pounds per square inch of pressure, based on the manufacturer's specification for that type of rubber. And when you're finished, you'll have a proto mold with a cavity for each of your models, which you can then go in and slice out the channels in order to pour in the molten metal, which then sits in your spin caster. The spin caster clamps the mold up against a lid, and you pour in a ladle full of hot metal while it's spinning around, and it flings all the metal to the outside, filling in your actual mold. And there's two kinds of molds. There's proto molds and production molds. Proto molds are where you have one piece of any specific thing, and a production mold is where you've spun out 8 or 10 or 50 of whatever happens to fit in your particular spin caster, and you've made a mold where you spin it once and spend 3 minutes and you get 50 parts instead of one. So a couple of examples here. The guy on the left, that's something that would be okay to put in a metal, metal mold. He's made entirely out of green stuff, which is an epoxy putty. It's a two-part yellow and green that you mix together. And metal, and nothing more. He's got some reinforcing metal inside of him, and that's about it. He'll be able to withstand the pressures. The guy on the right is a mixture of ABS plastics, polystyrene, some green stuff, some gray stuff, and a few other types of epoxy metals. You don't want to put him in your mold press, and here's why. If you put things that are petroleum-based things, plastics in particular, clays and other things like that that have certain chemical contents, at the very least, you'll ruin your master under the pressures that you're putting these under. At the very worst, your mold can actually explode. There's a rather famous story from Citadel Miniatures back in the day where one of their sculptors built a dragon that was completely looking like green stuff on the outside but had a giant block of polystyrene in the center. They cranked it up to about 15,000 pounds per square inch, blew the mold frame apart, destroyed a couple of machines, and sent one guy to the hospital. The mold frame that you see on the right there is actually half-inch thick cast steel that's been blown apart by somebody putting the wrong thing into their mold. If you're not careful, at the very least, you'll lose a mold frame and possibly a machine. If someone's nearby and the mold frame didn't explode, but they put something like super glue in that's under high pressure, when they go to release that pressure, it can spray out on them at, you know, 300-400 degrees of liquid cyanoacrylate. That's not fun. And worst case scenario, the thing actually explodes, sending half-inch thick steel shrapnels you know, spalling around your shop, sending a lot of people to the hospital. So don't put bad things in your metal molds. A couple of things. If you're actually interested in metal casting, there's a number of companies that are out there. Romanoff, Contenti, TechCast, and Connolly, which I didn't list here. They all make jewelry and white metal casting equipment. Their costs, like I said, range from anywhere from $2,500 to, you know, $10,000 for a package. And a lot of times you can find reconditioned rigs on eBay. One thing you'll want to look for and track down if you're interested in metal casting is the complete handbook of centrifugal casting by Philip Romanoff. He's the guy who started all this stuff back in the 50s of, rather than pouring open metal, actually trying to do high-speed production working in his basement. This guy is going to be your Bible. It tells you how to do anything and everything that you could ever want to do related to white metal casting. And you can pick him up on Amazon for about 10, 15 bucks. And you can laugh at, you know, the funny pictures of Phil in his flannel in his basement back in the 50s. Which brings us to resin casting. Cost and equipment is a lot less than doing metal casting. You need an air compressor, a pressure tank, and a vac table, all of which, depending on where you shop or how handy you are, can be anywhere from a couple $100 to at most $1,000 or so. Your master model can contain a lot more materials, like plastics are great for masters for resin casting. Clays work equally well. You can even use wood and other porous materials, provided that you seal them properly with lacquer. The silicone rubber that you use for these kinds of things has a tendency to get into every little nook and cranny and will actually peel out on your master if it's not properly sealed. The mold box is essentially a frame that goes around your mold that's going to hold the silicone while it's curing. A lot of people use Legos. They work fairly well, again, if you've sealed them properly with enough glue. Plexiglass held together with good old-fashioned hot glue out of a hot glue gun. Works amazingly well for this. It's easy to break away, it's completely watertight, it's lightweight, and it produces a nice shapely mold that you can pour into relatively easily. And of course, cutting your actual molds, you're going to want to go ahead and mark out on your master before you go ahead and pour the actual silicone in it so that you can cut across your cross section without goofing up any of the detail or undercuts or things like that. And then for actual resin casting, you can get commercially available mold release agents, or if you're using the right kind of tin cure silicone rubber, you can use baby powder, which is extremely cheap as your mold release to just have a little bit of a buffer layer between your actual casting urethane and your silicone rubber mold. And then, of course, you're going to want to both vacuum your resin once it's in your mold to pull any bubbles out, and depending on how complex your mold is, maybe even pressure it in a pressure tank in order to force the liquid resin back into all those little undercuts and nooks and crannies. And then, of course, there's your demold time, which depends largely on how big your mold is, temperature, humidity in the room, and so on, as well as what type of resin you're using. And you can do a lot of cool stuff with resin that you can't do with metal. There's some current and classic armor cast products that I pulled up there, the Steam Buddha, which is about 4 inches tall, which contains details down to half millimeter size that come out amazingly well in a silicone rubber mold, all the way up to the classic Battletech Madcap mech, which stands about 11.5 inches tall. It's a lot cheaper, it's a lot easier to work with, especially if you're new, and the nice thing about resin is once it's made, unlike metal, where if it goofs up, you have to re-pour it, resin cuts like wood, sands like wood, but you can heat it with a heat gun and rebend it and reshape it a little bit just like a plastic. So it's actually a pretty good thing to start out with if you're first getting into casting. Plus, you can make a lot larger things for a lot less cost. Which brings us to injection molding, and I think we're almost out of time here, aren't we? 3 minutes? Okay, I think I can get through this one at least. Simple quick story, beware the red dragon and look at I-Corps. I-Corps came out with a good game called Void a number of years ago that was giving Warhammer 40,000 and Warzone a run for its money. They had another game called Keltos. It was doing amazingly well. They decided to switch from metal models to plastic models. They sent their 3-ups over to China. Right before the Christmas season, they got their crates in and they got 3-ups back instead of getting 1-ups because the Chinese said, hey, you sent us a 3-up. We'll laser scan it in. We'll, you know, injection mold these things and send them off and we're done. I-Corps tried to get some remedy for this. They said, well, you didn't say to, you know, reduce it to a one-up, and they said, yes, we did. And then they said, well, ha, we're in China, screw you. And the Chinese government said, yeah, well, you should have learned to speak better Chinese. And I-Corps is now out of business, and their properties were sold off because they had product they couldn't sell that they were on the hook, had already paid for, that was ultimately going to bankrupt them since they couldn't bring it to market in time and didn't have the capital to redo it. So if you're going to injection mold, try to stay local or at least someplace that's English speaking. The biggest cost savings for injection molding is in the actual production. Pewter right now is running at about $16 a pound. Resin for roughly about 16 ounces. Resin for that same $16 gets you roughly about 48 ounces worth of material. $16 worth of polystyrene plastic is about 1 cubic meter worth of material. So you go from having a miniature whose cost is, in say, 30 cents a mini to 20 cents a mini to, you know, 0.03 cents worth of a miniature when you're actually producing it. Plus, the nice thing about injection molding is if you're using a, rather than a thermal set plastic, if you're using a plastic that can be reused, you throw it in a grinder, you dump it back in the thing, oh look, it came out right this time on the second run. There are some other advantages, like 3D modeling. You can have your molds grown in a lot of maker bots and things like that, have your masters produced for you, filed down, scanned in. You can sometimes just take a direct CAD file and send it off to your manufacturer, and they'll cut the mold and produce it for you and send you a finished product. And the nice thing about it is resin molds last for roughly 40 pulls, give or take. Pewter molds will last several hundred spins. Plastic injection molds last tens of thousands of production runs. There are guys using the same injection molds that were made 20 years ago for products that they're still producing today. Trade-off, of course, is even though you're saving all that money on the actual produced product, whereas a silicone mold is $20, $30 worth of silicone for a large piece, a miniature is going to cost you roughly $40 or $50 worth of mold rubber in your vulcanizing press. Don't even open the door if you can't afford $10,000 for an injection mold plus the $50,000 for the machine on top of that. Even if you outsource it, a limited run of a simple project of one figure is going to cost you $5,000 to $6,000 just for the first 100 runs of your product. But hey, if you've got that kind of capital behind you, you can keep producing that same thing for a very long time, and if it sells well, you have an initial investment that'll last you for decades without having any significant money have to go back into that product. We're time? Okay. Brings me to post-production here. Let me see how many more slides I had to go. Yeah, I probably had about 9 or 10 slides. So I guess we'll head upstairs to the breakout session if anyone wants to continue to hear me talk or if you just want to ask questions or what have you. Thanks for having me here. Next time I know I should probably budget another half hour if I decide to give this talk again. All right, thanks.